Clint Barton, aka Hawkeye, became the greatest sharpshooter known to man. He then joined the Avengers. This is what he does when he's not being an Avenger. I'm Eddie Webb, and today we're going to talk about Hawkeye issues 10 through 12 and the annual today on Speechless. Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Speechless, where I've been going through the Matt Fraction Hawkeye run issue by issue. And today we're kind of reaching the act 2 of, I think, the Hawkeye series. It doesn't quite break down into a neat arc, but certainly this is where things started to change in episode 2. Things are definitely heating up in this run of comics. So let's kind of dive right into it. About the last time we left off, Grills, who's actually his real name is Gil, had just been killed on the top of the roof by a man in white face paint who said he came from hell. So that is what kind of leads us directly into issue 10 of Hawkeye, which is written by Matt Fraction, is drawn by Francesco Francavilla. Color artist is Matt Hollingsworth and lettered by Chris Lipiolis. And this is one of the issues where David Aja is not doing the art on it. And for a while, actually, we're going to bounce back and forth between Francavilla and Aja. But Francavilla actually has a nice style. Again, with Eliopoulos's coloring, that bold, stark coloring, I think it really adds a lot to the line work. It's not nearly as clean as Aja's line work. It's much more kind of loose, but I think that adds to the tone of this overall issue. What we're doing is this is another issue where we are kind of bouncing back and forth in time. Where the now time frame is Kate Bishop is at a party where he sees a man in a white suit. And then we're also going backwards in time to a man in Kazi's background. And Kazi is the man that Kate sees at the party. So starts off with a man by the name of Kazimierz, I believe it's how it's pronounced. His family also ran a circus. So circus family themes are something that kind of runs through this series, ties into Hawkeye's background, it ties into Kazi's background. He basically sees the circus being burned to the ground. There are people who have been burned alive. He asks what's going on, and the man in a knit cap says, "Are you kidding? There's a war on." His mother and father are gone. They're finding a way to him and another younger child are trying to get out. Some men in trucks. We're cutting ahead a little bit, but they're hiding out in a building somewhere. Men in trucks with searchlights are saying that anyone who's they've been ordered to evacuate, and anyone who's still there is going to be shot. They are the men with guns find them, accuse them of being looters of the people behind. They're about to get shot when a man in a tracksuit shoots both of the soldiers down and says, "You bros okay? You better leave. See, it's about to get real ugly," which sets up that Kazi is going to be part of this group of the tracksuit mafia. Then we cut to modern day. Where Kate's talking about the history of New York, as her and Kazi are actually looking through a window down on the city. And so she's talking about the architecture, which is fascinating, how the city was made into a grid in 1807. But before that, it was a lot like the capitals of Europe, where there are circles and plazas for the street layout. Someone in New York cut up into 90-degree angles to make it easier to sell land. At one point in New York, there was a city, the fire was so large that you could see it into Philly. And then how the lights came in through Edison. So it's she's talking a lot about the history of New York and the things it's gone through, the ups and downs of it, and how it's a city that looks like it's very intricately planned, but it's actually kind of messy underneath. And it's again, a tone. Marvel, off and on, but generally more on, has always been good about turning New York City into a character for the comics. And in recent years, that has largely faded away. But because this is a more grounded series compared to, like, say, the normal Avengers run, it makes sense to kind of reestablish New York as that character ends. And this in here, Fraction is doing that very explicitly, intentionally, of kind of saying, you know, here. And actually, in the art, you see that there's a map of the city and photographs of New York that are taking place during this kind of long string of bubbles. And she talks about how she's falling in love with New York City. And Kaz's only response to all this is, "I feel nothing," which is very important to understanding Kaz's character. So again, we go back to time, and Kazi is now painted, in younger Kazi is painted as a clown, and is doing kind of a skit with the younger child. Like, "You love me, I love you, you love me," and kind of playing with the language back and forth. And some of the other men in the tracksuit mafia are laughing. And then there's a kind of a droning sound that cuts through the skit until there's an explosion. And then we find out that the other child's name is Yannick. But Yannick is dead as a result of what appears to be a bomb, while Kazi is painted in this face paint. And then we cut back to Kazi right after he just said, "I feel nothing." It's also fleeting, so transitory. He says a great line, which is, "It is said that you are a New Yorker the moment you remember the way New York used to be. And we are all New Yorkers then." So, you know, the idea that history is fashioned as trend and it's lost and overwritten, which is an interesting kind of balance to look at both of these, you know, from Kate's perspective and from an American perspective to a degree. The idea of looking at New York as this kind of historical state city that has a lot of depth and legacy, but from a European perspective, it's almost a fleeting glimpse from a historical perspective. Kazi is being very suave, and so, "Look at you, you're carved for porcelain." And Kate gets very nervous, and all of her line is run together. "It's my dad, probably don't really know why I'm here. Hi, I'm Kate." Great little show that she's trying to be this fashionable, suave New York socialite, and just sometimes doesn't get it right. So now we just oppose the kind of "you love me, I love you, you love me" thing. But now Kazi's looking into a mirror and painting himself with face paint that we recognize as the face paint of the man who shot Grills. So Kazi is in fact the assassin that was hired by Tracksuit Mafia to kill Hawkeye. So now we have Kate and Kazi talking together, and Kazi's talking about his work. Because he's talking about his real first day of work. Well, it's juxtaposed over a picture of him shooting a lot of people. So we now know he's an assassin. And then Kate's talking about her job, which is as Hawkeye. So they're both trying to have, which on the surface is like a kind of a mundane conversation. And like even Kazi makes a joke of, you know, people you can't live with, can't kill them, or at least you're not supposed to. And so it's kind of like, that's a funny, charming thing to say. But we also know the truth behind that. Whereas Kate, of course, being an Avenger, is like, that's definitely frowned upon in my job. So they're talking at odds, but it starts cutting between images of like him dragging a finger over her shoulder, her putting her hand on her thigh, cutting in on her lips and then his lips. So definitely there's, you know, a lot of sexual tension between these two. And then after that, you know, page, we cut back to this much more jagged, aggressive page of Kazi strangling a man and shooting someone, drowning someone in a bathtub, setting someone on fire. So he's not only is he an assassin, but, you know, he's prolific and he's aggressive. Then there's a scene of him in a bar being paid money to look at a man, but I can make money doing what I love. Him shooting that man, blood splattering his face, and then back to the bar where the man, a younger version of the man in the white tracksuit, the leader of the mafia, says, "Work for us, bro. We make you rich." And that was kind of his ticket out. So we're cutting back and forth. And as he gets up to leave with Kate, he leans with the comment of, I came from hell and be seeing you, Kate Bishop. So the I came from hell line is going to keep coming back. But the best part is he turned a page and then kind of at the elevator and Kate comes in. It's like, hey, you don't get to do that. You don't get to do the Joe cool guy exit like that. You're not the hero of the story. I am. Which is fascinating because this is one of the things where physicality of comics really, really help because it's a two-page spread and the kind of him walking away, be seeing you, Kate's at the bottom of the page. And so as comics readers, we're trained that the next part is going to be another scene, but it's not. It's actually the continuation of that scene and Kate takes agency out of that scene. It's like, you know, the guy doing a cool exit, she grabs control of that. But then she actually kisses him. We find out that he's 34 and so you should know better. I on the other hand, don't. So she's at this point, I think literally half his age. But you know, 17 year old girl, she's trying to get ages, but she's also making mistakes. It's a fine balance, but I think both Kate and Clint really get presented well as flawed individuals. So Kazi gets his makeup painted up and he's waiting outside in Hawkeye's apartment. He watches Kate go in. We see Clint shooting at the target and he just keeps, he's hitting the target, but he's hitting the edges, clearly frustrated. Damn it. And then Kate shoots with him and actually shoots better than him. And finally, Clint goes, what do you want? And snaps at her. You know, Kate kind of calls him out and it's like, you don't get to yell at me on the people you get to yell at. I'm very low on that list. And out of her frustration, she shoots again, actually splits the arrow she previously shot in, mirroring the scene where Hawkeye did that all the way back in Young Avengers Presents. And then she calls him a clown and leaves, which again is poignant because Kazi dresses up as a clown when he does his killing. So we see again that last page of Grills being assassinated when the conscience said, told you I came from hell. So now we understand that line from the previous issue. Then we go to issue 11, which is Pizza is My Business, written by Matt Fraction, art by Dave Aja, color by Matt Hollingsworth, and lettered by Chris Eliopoulos. I'm going to get that name right. And this issue is one of my favorites, mostly because this is Aja doing what he's great at. I mentioned before about fill-in issues, and we'll get to the actual fill-in section probably next episode. But one of the reasons why we're kind of bouncing with Frank Avella is that when Aja gets really into a beautiful, dense issue, it could take him a longer time. And that's something he admitted to in interviews is that he sometimes took longer with issues. And a couple of times, Matt had to kind of write fill-in scripts to kind of help give David the time he needed to finish the art. But this is a great example of what David Aja can do when he has that time. So this entire episode, entire issue is done from the perspective of Pizza Dog, Lucky. Call different things depending on who's calling them, but this is from a dog's perspective. And so there's a great thing of starts off kind of heavily zoomed in on some word balloons. We see an H and then we see kind of part of a what. And then so that fight that Kate and Clint had where Clint was just snapping at her, we're now seeing that from Lucky's perspective. And what's interesting is that as the word balloons zoom out, a lot of the words are kind of just hash marks. We actually don't see what's being said. So, for example, we hear, you know, Kate goes, blah, 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 me, blah, 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 help, blah, 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 Kate, blah, 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 help, don't. So, Lucky is picking up certain words. And, you know, as we keep zooming out, we just see Lucky's there. And eventually Lucky leaves the apartment during the fight. But At one point in the middle of the page, Clint and Kate are framed. Clint is on the left, Kate is on the right. And the left side, we have this great little icon of a picture of Clint's face and then different circles coming off of it with arrows. It's like a picture of a person holding a bow. There's a picture of coffee, there's a picture of dog food and a little arrow. And then Kate has a similar iconized version of her head, and then also a picture of coffee and flowers and martini glass and lipstick and pizza and a heart. And so we get the idea of this is how Lucky views the humans in his life. These are things that he associates with them. And that kind of helps as he leaves, and then he starts walking by different apartment buildings. And so we see pictures of the neighbors that we've seen throughout the series thus far. We see the mother with her two boys and the dripping faucet and candy and a little toy and so on. And what's interesting is he walks by Gil's room and there's a big kind of cross through his face and a question mark. So it's a very poignant, subtle thing telling extremely visually what happened, which is that he's missing. You haven't seen him in a while. And that's a big part of this issue is that there's very little dialogue. It's almost entirely done through imagery. The entire story is told through imagery, which is the start of the Hawkeye the comic saying that you don't need to hear what's going on to understand what's going on. That sets you up for a future comic issues that are coming down the line. I don't know if it was intentional or not. I'm inclined to think it was because Matt Fraction is someone who's had hearing loss in his life before, and I believe has hearing loss himself. So I believe that some of this was intentional or at least subconscious. But certainly this is an issue where we don't see a whole lot. But one of the plots of this issue is that a tiny puppy, which looks a lot like Lucky, comes up and starts barking at Lucky and sniffing. And then the puppy goes off and Lucky follows. And the relationship between Lucky and this tiny puppy is clearly meant to mirror the relationship between Clint and Kate. Clint is Lucky in this case. The tiny puppy is Kate in this case. And it comes out later chronologically, but we are reviewed where Clint has the flashback and again makes an analogy of the younger dog as Kate and the older dog as Clint. In production order, this is the first example of that, but we've already seen this pairing before. And I think it reads better to see that pairing again because I think it helps to kind of ground what's happening here. So anyway, the younger dog takes Lucky to where Gil has been shot. And so we see him bloodied face down on the roof. And then page cuts to a very 60s spy kind of image where Gil is in very cutouts and it says pizza dog in pizza is my business. So it's meant to kind of evoke that 60s James Bond era. And Lucky starts sniffing and the page changes to almost like a police sketch layout. So we see where everything is oriented on the roof and there are numbers by each of them. And by the numbers are different icons number one is by where Gil is dead, and we see a skull and crossbones, we see a beer, we see a grill, and we see Gil's face. Number two is by the door, and we see like kind of an exit sign, and then more beers, and then Clint. And then there are footsteps throughout, which looks like they could be bloodstained footprints, but it's also kind of implied that it's smell that Lucky's tracking. And then we have question mark, gun odor, makeup, lipstick, but again, kind of makeup. So the previous pages of establishing thoughts in Lucky's head as images, these are now turned into clues. And Lucky reconstructs what happens of someone shooting and then climbing over the side of the building into a car that then drives off. Again, this is all told through pictures. And so it's hard to review in an audio-only podcast. That's why I'm hoping you're reading these along to really get a sense of this. But we have Lucky going away, going in the alley, sit down, eating an abandoned piece of pizza, and going through all of the different images of people he knows in his head. A lot of the images are scent-based. So I've always associated these thoughts are odors, but there are certain ones that don't quite make sense. But in this case, like, you know, there are diapers associated with the mom, with the artist, we have shaved pencils, with Clint, again, coffee beans and coffee, and then pizza. Then we see a zoom in on Lucky's ear. And again, we actually see the interior of the ear. So it's like a drawing of his biology. So like we actually see like the middle ear going in the cochlea as inside of his skull as his ear perks up. And then there's a van driving away. And we see two men coming out of the van talking to a man with a bindle over his neck. This is not a character we have been introduced to yet in the story. So we've moved from a scene that we've already seen from Lucky's perspective, and now Lucky is looking into a scene that we have yet to see. So I won't spoil yet what the situation is, but from the images, two of the men are in fact the tracksuit mafia, because we see from their kind of knees down. Another man looks like he's homeless. The tracksuit mafia beat up the homeless man. Lucky barks at them. The one of the tracksuit men says Arrow, and we remember from the first couple of issues that Arrow was the name around the dog's neck. So this is probably Lucky's previous owner when Clint's assaulted the tracksuit mafia. And we see images of the two men and, like, you know, pictures of one of them kicking a dog, another one hitting a dog with a stick, and a bone with a cross. So Lucky does not associate positive memories with these two men. So Lucky runs, goes back in, and we see there are word balloons now, but again, we're only getting a couple words. Ex-wife, points, Avenger, question, and it's Clint talking to two police officers, and they're all drinking coffee. The only dialogue we see that is complete is when Clint looks down at Lucky and says, good boy, which is so, every time I see it, I grin, because it's so epitomized the dog experience, with blah, 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 word, blah, 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 word, but you said a good boy. And I remember that. And I know that. And then we have a great picture of Lucky with his tongue out, just smiling ear to ear. Then Kate is dressed up in a black dress, and she is helping Clint tie a tie for a black suit. And then as they leave, they're again talking. We get bits and pieces of it. We're seeing more of those scent icons. And another piece I didn't mention is that when we're in Lucky's headspace, the color fades away and the imagery, the background, is drawn almost like an architectural drawing. It's a white background and all of the lines are done in blue, like architectural pencil. And then the images are over top of that. When we shift to when Lucky is in a scene or engaging in a scene, then we get our more traditional David Aja art and coloring. So, and sometimes the panel, we have the whole scene, but only a slice of that is actually paneled out and colored. So we have Lucky walking from the apartments to the door. And so as Clint and Kate are walking to the door with Lucky walking with them, behind Lucky, we see all those images of the different scents and thoughts and ideas he has. But then when the two of them are talking, it's, again, presented like the more traditional comic. But at one point in time, Clint points to him and says, keep eye place. We can kind of deduce, keep an eye on the place from there. And Lucky puts his paw up next to his hand, which is, it's like saluting. It's like, obviously the dog's not saluting. It's more kind of what he's doing in his head. And then we have a whole page of him sitting in front of the building with all these different images of like a person playing saxophone and a ambulance siren and a hydrant and a truck. So he's watching all the stuff going by and he's guarding in front of the door the same way that Clint has done in previous issues. So the young puppy comes back, and walks by and kind of puts his head up. And so, we see a little kind of broken heart above, Lucky's face. And then the puppy sticks his head out and comes back and wags his tail. And so we see the heart kind of actually rejoin, little arrows pointing the two pieces of the heart back together. And then Lucky follows him and they're cuddled up on the ground. When Lucky hears something, goes to look into it. The small puppy is kind of barking and pulling, and then Lucky gives the big dog bark, oof, to scare the puppy off as Lucky looks out the window to see what's going on. And we see the two tracksuit mafia people climbing up on top of the roof. It's very much the puppy like, I'm trying to stop you, and Lucky's having none of it. So Lucky rushes out of the apartments through some police tape to that roof scene. Again, we see two of the tracksuit mafia. And then we see Kazi. there, and we see that there's a look at the numbers for the police scene there. So the police have been to the apartments, you know, presumably after the police were talking to Clint in the previous scene. Again, we have, literally the lines we see are bro, bro. I mean, so bro is the only word really reading through this entire exchange, and a little bit of what appears to be an Eastern European language, I believe Polish. But then Kazi sees the dog. Lucky attacks, bites one of the people to get the gun out of their hands. Lucky, they try to shoot at Lucky. Lucky dodges out of the way and ends up shooting the other person in the leg. And then Kazi actually just starts punching Lucky. And then Lucky actually jumps onto one of the men and knocks over a building, and Lucky falls over the edge of the building with. So we cut to an old woman who's wearing a necklace with an Uzi as part of the necklace. And she is in her apartments talking to Kazi and one of the Trexit Mafia whose leg has been bandaged up. We do see Lucky and the small puppy there. The other man, there's a key icon in the door icon. We see someone trying to unlock the door to come in the apartment. As soon as the door opens, Lucky bolts through the door as another man steps in and starts rushing down the staircase. And again, the staircase is done in that kind of extremely clinical architectural style. And as we see icons, there's a man with a gun, doors, but also lots of caution symbols, caution, 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 which kind of sells Lucky's anxiety. And then he runs out the door. We see Clint. Clint says, "Come, good boy." And of course, Lucky pounces on him, starts licking him. And Clint says, "Stop eating garbage." Lucky, come, good Lucky, Lucky Pizza. So when Clint is talking to Lucky, we see a lot more of the dialogue. When Clint is not talking to Lucky, he's talking to Kate, we see less of it. And it's a subtle way of showing that when Lucky is paying attention and when Lucky's not. So what we started off as going, the dog doesn't understand what's going on, we now reframed into Lucky understands a lot more than he lets on. But he's a dog, so if someone's talking to me, I don't really care. Lucky yawns and wakes up, and we see Kate is carrying a bunch of bags. Clint's eating cereal on the counter. Kate is stepping out the door, and then finally Kate says, "Come on, Lucky." And Lucky walks out the door after her, and Clint says, hey. And then Kate is in a car. We see a map of the United States, and she is driving from New York all the way to somewhere in California, and Lucky is in the car with her as it's revealed they're driving on California, Route 66. So a lot happens in an issue with very little understandable dialogue, all told from a dog's perspective. And if you had told me previously to this that an issue from a dog's perspective would be one of the most heartwarming and almost emotional issues of the series, I would have called you a liar. But it's true. It's genuinely affecting. But part of that is because Aja takes so much time to balance between these two different styles and uses them very strategically and very carefully. It's a lot of work, a lot more work than you would normally see in a traditional comic book from around 10 years ago. So then we move into issue 12, which is written by Matt Fraction, art by Francesco Francavilla, color art also by Francesco Francavilla, and lettered by Chris Eliopoulos. So this is actually one where Francesco both drew and colored himself. And this is, we're now going to see one of those scenes, at least from the perspective that we saw from issue 11 and now issue 12. And we see the homeless man from issue 11, who is in a payphone talking to someone, which is interesting because this is 2012. So I think we're at that strange stage where there are still a few payphone booths left in the world, but they were definitely fading away. So when I read this a couple of years later, it almost felt strictly anachronistic, but I think time-wise, they would have been like maybe a few of those still around. But he's talking to someone and he just says, "Hey, guess what? There's a paw and it's a chicken butt." And that's something, again, we'll tie into later. So we're getting only the phone call from his perspective. We're setting up a meeting with someone for tomorrow at 9. He's then ringing a doorbell. We can see the name on there is Barton. A woman walks by carrying her bike. And he asks her for a change, and she kind of ignores him and goes, eh, worth a shot. He walks over towards a van, and he's like, hey, do you have any spare change? And then the tracksuit mafia guy's like, you know, bro, are you seriously trying to you know, hit us up for change? And finally, he's like, I will give you a whole dollar if you let me punch you in the face. And then the guy says, okay, $5. And they laugh. They punch him in the face. And he goes, okay, fine, $5. And they punch him again. At that point in time, Lucky comes in, or goes Arrow. And the homeless man takes off. He counts something in his hands, turns to be 38 cents in his hand. And he's like, yeah, don't think I'm going to forget how much I started with. And then it cuts to what appears to be in the past, because it's someone talking to Clint, but Clint's clearly a young child. And again, holding some loose change. And he's like, you know, don't take the dimes. They're too small. The penny doesn't know if you need a nickel. And he talks about snapping the nickel. And he's like, you just got to snap like this. And he snaps his fingers and the nickel flashes and breaks a bottle, which is the same trick that Clint did several issues ago when they had the party, the rooftop party. So we're finding out now, you know, this is where Clint learned that trick from, is from this man. And as the boys get in the house now, and inside the house, we see a man drinking directly from a bottle and a woman holding a bloody handkerchief to her nose as they sit at the dinner and they're looking at it. So this is Clint's brother. We now kind of established that. And basically their father starts to verbally abuse the boys. Eventually, Clint jumps on the table and goes to attack the father. We cut to Clint's bedroom, and his brother comes in and calls him a dumbass. And he's like, wow, he really wailed on you. Yeah, it's not that you aren't brave, you're just too little. You need to get strong before you do crazy stuff like this. And so he teaches Clint how to throw a punch, but also take a punch. And then he's like, you know, guess what? Chicken butt. And so, okay, this is the same person. So we cut to the homeless man. We still have a name for it, even though we understand contextually he is. He's sleeping rough, and then a whole bunch of tracksuit mafia come up and say, you know, give us 2 minutes, and we'll give this roll of money. And so they beat up on him for 2 minutes. They're laughing the whole time. They're kicking him in the ribs. They're punching him in the face, and then finally, he grabs one of their heels and goes, "Hey, your 2 minutes are up." And they're laughing, and they find, and then the homeless man says, "I'd be lying if I said I wasn't hoping this would happen again," and proceeds to then fight them all again. So this is the man who taught Clint how to fight. Clearly he's very good at fighting back. And he's saying, "You don't get to welch on me twice." And so they're screaming, "Bro, bro, 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 bro." They run back to the van, and he pulls out a bow and arrow from his bag and shoots the tire in the van. So he grabs the roll. He goes to the van. It's crashed into a lamppost. He grabs the roll of cash from one of the guys who are unconscious and says, "You also owe me $5. And so he goes to the liquor store. And it's like, you know, give me a bottle of anything and a quarter to make a phone call. Can you break 100? So he calls back and he's like, you know, "Hey, guess what, chicken butt?" So this is clearly a childhood thing between them. And we cut to a scene of a car crash, and there's jags of glass in which we can see a man's head rolling against a wheel, bottles in the seat, a woman's eyes open with blood damage. So and this man, terrible accident. I'm afraid your parents are dead. So their parents died in a car wreck. And then we cut to the police telling them, and there's just lots of silence as Clint's kind of, his eyes are closed, his brother's eyes are open, and finally Clint turns away and just says, "Good." So right to modern day, we see Clint sitting with Lucky. So this is before Kate and Lucky left. He opens the door and we see the homeless man's like, "Do you just pay the price for a cup of coffee?" And Clint says, "Same old Barney, come here," and they hug. So that's the end of the issue, and find out that his brother's name is Barney, and Barney has come to stay with Clint. And this is interesting because Barney is established in continuity. What's interesting about the Hawkeye series is that you can definitely read this and not know anything previous about Marvel history. And that's how I originally read it. I read this not knowing much about the Hawkeye character. But because of this series, I have then since gone back and reread the Old Avengers issues and West Coast Avengers. And Barney does come up in the late 60s, early 70s, I believe. And Clint's circus ties and a lot of these characters do have previous things, but they're presented very differently. Barney and Clint's relationship is very different than what's presented in here. So it's interesting now seeing it stuff and saying, oh, this is so different. And so I'm slowly reading to see if that changes, but I suspect Barney's one of those characters that probably got forgotten for decades. And then we have Matt Fraction bringing it back up and kind of tying him back into Clint's story. Now we go to the Hawkeye Annual, West Coast Avenger, written by Matt Fraction, art by Javier Pulido, color art by Matt Hollingsworth, and letterer by Clayton Cowles. And annuals are interesting issues. These are generally comics that were bigger than a typical comic. They were done about once a year, hence the name. They were more often done in the 60s and 70s and a little bit into the 80s. But in the past 20 years, annuals have kind of fallen away because traditionally an annual is meant to be a semi-out-of-continuity story that you can kind of just drop anywhere. And usually a largely different creative team will do it in parallel with the core series. So it's going to sell a bigger issue. And it's also a way to kind of get people who are casually interested in the comic as something to pick up as a one-and-done story. And if they like it, they may go and seek out the actual series. This does not work that way. This is very much embedded in continuity. It has to slot in. It kind of slots in the middle of issue 11. But it's really a prototype for what's going to happen in the series in the future. This is really kind of the backdoor pilot for the second Hawkeye series is going to happen inside the Hawkeye series. And I'll explain it when I get there. But suffice to say, as we saw in issue 11, Kate's going to go off on her own and she's going to have her own adventures. And that's going to happen as if it were a separate comic book, but it's going to be inside this run. So this is kind of the lead up to that. And this art team is largely what's going to be handling those issues. So Javier Pulido is going to be the main artist for the Kate Bishop ones. And I've mentioned previously, I'm not a huge fan of Javier Pulido's artwork, partially because he has heavy use of silhouettes, when he's blocking out scenes. And every once in a while for, effect or to kind of get a point across, silhouettes can be useful. But in the first three pages, most every panel is a character in silhouette, and it's not meant to be dark. I don't know if the intent is laziness, but it certainly feels that way when it looks like that way on the page. It looks like the artist just didn't spend the time to actually draw the detail or didn't have the time. And it's particularly with Hollingsworth's coloring, which is so clearly intentional and intention and designed to get a certain mood across, these huge blobs of black really detract from the overall coloring feel of the piece. So again, something I'm not a fan of. Some people really like the art and the way these flow. There's a lot of positives to the art that I'll get to as I go through the issues, but I want to say up front, this is not a case of, well, next to David Aja, it's not great. I genuinely don't think these are the best visually art, but they're really good stories. So you kind of need to read them to understand the context of everything else going on. So now we see the Kate leaving scene from Kate and Clint's perspective. So again, this is more or less in the middle of issue 11. And Kate's like, I gotta get out of here for a while. And Clint's like, yeah, do whatever. And she's like, I can't stick around and watch you do this to yourself anymore. And Clint's just like, shut up. Why are you taking my stuff? And it's like, this is my stuff. You had that much stuff over? And then Clint kind of pauses and is like, okay, sure, whatever. So Kate and him have a fight. And the thrust of the fight is that she thinks that every time Clint runs into a problem, he shuts down and just leaves or bails out. It's like you made a decision to make this place your home, to make these people your family, and you can't just leave when it gets hard. And of course, he responds with, so you're going to go back to Midtown, back to Daddy's, kind of throwing in her face that being a daughter of a rich family, it's very easy for her to escape the situation if she wants to. So she grabs his quiver. He mentions that, you know, some of the weird arrows might be in her quiver accidentally. So just don't take it in a plane or blow it off. And so where are you going to go? And he's like, I don't know, Los Angeles, maybe. And he's like, you know, the West Coast told you to the Hawkeye, which is, again, a nice touch because the West Coast Avengers were formed by Hawkeye originally. So it's a nice nod. I think it's a callback to Hawkeye's long history. So there will actually be a Hawkeye in New York and a Hawkeye in Los Angeles, even though Clint has been in both places. Now they'll be placed simultaneously. So it's a way to kind of explore some of the West Coast Avengers. And without going into a whole retrospective of West Coast Avengers, suffice to say, they were a little more unusual adventurers. So the Avengers at the time of the 80s when West Coast came out was generally pretty kind of staid at this point. The Avengers formula had been figured out. They generally did the bigger, sometimes more cosmic adventures, sometimes, which is kind of the more kind of traditional Marvel adventures, particularly those that we see coming out of the 80s. So there are the people that are going up against Dr. Doom. These are the people that are going to team up with the X-Men or the Fantastic Four. They're going to be involved in the crossover events. They're an established known quantity. The West Coast Avengers have the Avengers dynamic, but they generally did the more unusual stuff. Like they had Moon Knight on their team for a while, even though he never formally joined. There's an entire plot arc of Hawkeye struggling to get another member of the team because they keep quitting. And they run into weird things like, AIM and, science, Nazis and all sorts of strange stuff. So it's not funny, but it is just kind of the outer, weirder parts of the Marvel Universe tended to end up in the West Coast Avengers comic. So we're going to see that tonal shift happening to a degree in this comic. She takes Lucky. And he's like, you're not my girlfriend. You can't just take my dog. And then finally answer, who the hell do you think you are? Then we cut to, who is Kate Bishop? And it turns out that is prefacing a meeting of shadowy figures. And this is a case where the shadowy figures would have worked if it hadn't been so heavily used in the previous three pages. But someone giving a briefing about Kate's meeting in Madripoor when she was getting the videotape that was believed to be showing Clint assassinating someone. And that just last time we saw, I believe, Javier Pulido's art. And so this is Madame Mask, who was embarrassed. If you recall, she took Madame Mask's identity during the auction. And so Madame Mask has been trying to get information on this Kate Bishop. Basically catching her up to where the audience is at. And because it's an annual, it also acts as a light recap for where the Hawkeye comic is as far. Again, it could be an entry point for people new to the series. So that part of the annual, I think, is still working here. Kate shows up to a hotel, and she's like, Mama Lank. It's a very nice hotel. Really horrible German accents. I'm here for a dance a lot, and I'm here for the drinking in the pool, boys. But then he's like, what? It's like, fine, my game's capable. I'm here for a reservation. We see Kate's thought process during this whole issue. And what's interesting is that traditionally comic books used to use thought balloons, and that went out of fashion about the turn of the century. Turn of the millennium, I should say, around 2000, it started to move towards caption boxes, which originally used for narration. Then narration went away, and basically it became internal thoughts being caption boxes. And a lot of the ways you distinguish caption boxes in modern comics is through color or a symbol or whatnot. In this case, what's happening is the artist is actually takes an image of Kate's, and it's very cartoony anime, and puts it inside the caption box. So we're getting kind of Kate's reaction to how she wants to react to things inside of her head. And again, it's frustrating because like so much of her actual reaction is blacked out. So in my head, it's like, why don't you just put that reaction on the page? But it does really help to kind of sell what she's thinking and gives some context and emotion to it. Because she's such a sarcastic character, it allows you to see when she's being sincere or when she's being sarcastic, even in her own head. So it does actually work. But anyway, she's probably put a credit card. Her credit card's been declined. So Kate goes to talk to her father. And again, starts with, who is Kate Bishop? I don't even know who you are anymore. So the who is Kate Bishop line is something that's kind of threading through this whole annual. Her father is in a very, very luxurious Spartan apartment. And he's sitting with a woman who is his new wife. And there's a big debate about whether to call her mom, because it's a woman who's clearly much younger than him. And so I won't call her mom. It's like, your sister calls her mom. And they talk about what's going on about, you know, hey, you can come with us. We're going to yacht around the world, you know, go see the world. And she declines. So she gets into a car, which of course is purple, and she gets out and she drives to West Coast. They call her father, Mr. Bentley. He's the one to cut off the credit card. They tell the hotel to destroy the card. So she's sitting by the poolside waiting to get the card sorted out. And as she's sitting there, a woman shows up. She's wearing a white bikini and sunglasses. Kate's smitten by her. And it's interesting because it's hard to tell whether she's sexually attracted to the woman, or if she's just simply in awe of the woman, or if this is aspiration, like this is the woman she wants to be when she grows up. There's a lot of nuance happening here, but she clearly is fumbling. Like, for example, she introduced herself as Kate Hawkeye. Bishop. Your name is Kate Bishop Kate Hawkeye? Kate Bishop. He's like, I'm sorry, I'm really not thinking. Lucky takes off, and then she's trying to call him, and he's like, no, he's like, Lucky, Arrow, Pizza Dogs, anything. But she's coming because the car has been impounded and her luggage has been opened and confiscated. Lucky's trying to save the equipment, particularly the bow and arrow. It turns out that apparently there are massive back payments that she has not made, or someone has not made in the card. All of these items are being repossessed by men who are dressed as bellhops. She mentioned comment about bell boys, and she cracked to be called bell men. It's a funny exchange. And it's like, you know, who's doing this? Like, gangs, what can you do? The woman who saw her thing, witnessed the whole thing, takes her out to eat. And Kate was like, I was gonna Google you to see if I knew who you were, but I didn't get anything. And she introduced herself as Whitney Frost. Longtime readers will recognize that Whitney Frost is in fact Madame Mask, but Kate does not know this. And what's interesting is that Whitney Frost, the reason why she is Madame Mask is because her face has been disfigured. She's a very beautiful, striking woman. So that does kind of open a question. It's possible that may have been changed in continuity and I just missed that part. She's pretty open. I mean, you're not open about the fact that she is Madame Mask, but she's open about the rest of her life. You know, she was born in Italy to a count spoiled rotten, left her for dead, take over the family business, which was the Magia, which is the Marvel version of the Mafia. It's like, you know, my doctors think I have a permanent sleep disorder. But then she says, like, you know, the family business is murder. She's saying, like, the family business is hard. But she literally means the family business is murder. So again, similar to Kate's talk with Kazi, there's this dynamic of people being very blunt about what they're saying, but coaching it in ways that sounds like they're joking or using colloquialisms. Matt Fraction loves to play with language, and sometimes it gets a bit much, I'm not going to lie, but for this kind of hard-boiled, sarcastic characters living in a world that's also hard-boiled and sarcastic, it makes a lot of sense. So tonally, it really fits. Kate, it's like, you know, I need a place to stay. And so Whitney offers, I have a amount of space I can't use it all. And so Kate's like, I have like $80. And she's like, no, keep your money. let me just be a good Samaritan. And it's like, hey, you're a kid. Kids smoke. Do you have any cigarettes? And Kate remembers when Madam asks, like, you know, children smoke cigarettes. Do you have one? So Kate's starting to already put things together. And it's like, sorry, never picked it up. And so you go. It's a beautiful kind of, again, very modern looking house. We also, again, lots of black images. I'm going to keep going back to it. It's something that continues to bug me because I think it just drags the life out of the page. But there's a nice scene of her walking around, and as she's walking through this very elaborate kind of courtyard, she's also thinking to herself about, you know, we can call dad, or you can call your team, you can call anybody else. And Kate, as well, inner Kate is trying to talk her into sensible things, actual Kate is like, you know, no, we'll just make this work. It's fine. We'll do it. We'll let it ride. It's like, we're a tautology. We're the unknown unknown. And she's talking to Bucky as she's doing this. So inside her head, she realizes this is a bad idea, but she just is going to do it, which is 17-year-old experience in my experience. It's like, you know, yeah, this'll be fun. We cut back to when Kate talked to her father, and we start to see why that dynamic is, it's like, I need to go live my own life. I can't keep living off of you. So I need to go off and do my own things. And then she walks away from him, and the father's like, but I pay all of your bills. So it's the, what a rich woman's understanding of freedom is versus the reality of freedom. We cut back to Whitney Frost and Kate having dinner at their house, and cut to Whitney Frost opening, putting her ring over a bottle of wine or glass of wine and some white powder coming out. Classic, like, I'm going to poison you. And then as the conversation is going on, it's kind of a casual conversation. Why you're in LA? I'm not sure. But then, like, the boxes are like, you know, she must put something in the drink, execute the perfect sip, and then, you know, pour it into a plant behind her, which wilts. And then, like, the caption box is like, holy crap. But she's still, like, she's talking, and it's like speaking in comfort zones. And now she's pretending to be drunk. She had a plan. Then you go to sleep, and so she starts snoring. And then as soon as the door closes, she gets up and takes Lucky with her to get out. And Kate has figured out she's Madam Mask. I need evidence. I need to figure out some proof of this. And so she gets into the basement, which is where her car is, and she sees guns and about a dozen uniforms of Madam Mask. So it's like, okay, Lucky, get in the car. So they get in the car. She drives through out of the garage, ruins the car, and then Madam Mask points the gun, and it's like her. She's waiting for her, and it's like, I don't know how you're going to pay for that, but you're going to pay for that. And it's like, do you realize how cosmically oriented this revenge is? Madam Mask is so furious. And it's like, I never understood why you didn't take my mask off when you had the chance. Just think you could have avoided all this if you'd only peeked. And Kate says, that's the difference between me and you. I respect boundaries. Is your name really Whitney Frost? I think Madam Mask is like, unbelievable. Get out of the car. So Kate drives backwards, runs into the various different versions of Madam Mask in the garage. And then she falls. He's like, ta-da! And then she falls unconscious. The bellhops, which are currently working for Madam Mask, grab Kate in. She pulls out the keys, and she's like, you know, she mentions the key fob, which way back during the car fight scene, that the delayed exploding arrows activated with key fob. And so it's a callback to, I think, issue 4. She goes, key fob jobby, suck it, super bitch. She pushes the button, explodes the garage. Kate runs away with Madam Mask saying, I'm going to kill a little girl. Kate Bishop is going to die in California. We cut to Kate sitting in another restaurant talking to people. We eventually see our two kind of older aging hippies. And she's telling her story of, like, you know, I never really had a job, but I worked hard. I work harder than you believe. I can do this. And then the woman like, that's surprisingly intense. We just need someone to watch our cats. I can do this. And so she has a job as a cat sitter. And so she goes to a sporting goods store to buy bow and arrow because she doesn't have a bow and arrow. She blew it up with Madame Mask's apartment. And so it's like, you know, comes to $282 and she has 80, you know, 58 something. So she's like, you know, I'm gonna do this and work hard in every life. And the cashier's like, you know, basically, ma'am, this is a Wendy's. You know, she's saying no idea what's going on, but she goes into inner monologue. I'm gonna work really hard at this, you know. We've all seen Welcome. And she says the exact same speech she gave to the older woman she took the cats for, but now she's doing it in her head. But that's where the end of the issue is. She's sitting on top of a trailer where the women live with Lucky and looking at the sunset. And so she's like, I'm going to make this work. So that's where we wrap up. Kate Bishop is in LA. She has nothing to her name. And she's trying to work a job when she's never worked a job a day in her life. But she's going to work hard, which is the core of both Hawkeye characters, is that they tend to get into a lot of problems. They are, on paper, the weakest characters. They don't have superpowers. They defeat people with a bow and a stick. But when they're knocked down, they get back up. And now we're able to see that. While this is definitely a funnier take on it, Kate's going through similar situation to Clint. It's like, no matter how bad they get beaten down, she's going to get back up, but she's doing it in her own style, in her own way. She's not Clint Barton. She's coming from a different perspective. And some of that is very much from a perspective of privilege and learning how to overcome that privilege. But some of it also is just, she doesn't quite understand what the consequences can truly be. Whereas someone like Madame Mask absolutely can. So Kay Bishop now has her own kind of cadre of antagonists and her own situation in LA. And so going forward, we're actually going to bounce back and forth a bit between them. Episode 4, we're going to go issues 13 through 16 and issue 18. So that gets us to the fill-in issue we did way back in issue or episode 1. And issue 18 is definitely kind of my favorite issue. That is the well-known, I think at this point in time, sign language issue. So I'm excited to talk about that. And I may end up skimming over some of the other issues to kind of get to that because some of that is also Kate getting established in LA and whatnot, which is still a fun story. Don't get me wrong. I think getting to actually, I'm wrong. That is not the sign language issue. It is that's a different issue. I'm flipping through now. We will get to that. So that is our next set of issues. So with that, if you want to know more about me, you could find me on Twitter at Pugsteady. That's P-U-G-S-T-E-A-D-Y. You could find my website at pugsteady.com. And I also even have a newsletter if you want to sign up and get more information about projects I'm working on, the like. But other than that, I will see you in 2 weeks with episode 4. Take care.